Hi there, it's Jill Conrath, and I am back right now with Brett Adamson. He is the co-author of The Challenger Sale, one of my favorite books, and he is also the managing director of the advisory services for CEB's sales and marketing practice. Now that's a mouthful, but what that means is he's pretty smart about what's happening in the sales field today because he and his company are constantly surveying sales organizations to find out what's going on. So thanks for being here today.
Absolutely, Jill. Happy to be with you.
I am so glad you're here because I want to talk briefly about the Challenger Sale, and then I want to talk about what's on beyond the Challenger Sale. And your book came out when?
It came out in, that's a good question, 2011. November 2011.
Groundbreaking research that you had that has totally changed the conversation about sales in the last few years. Can you give a brief synopsis of what it is that you guys uncovered in your research and what are you recommending today?
Absolutely. By the way, first thing on the introduction, one thing I always tell people I do for CB is I'm the pretty face, but no one will believe me, and I don't know why.
It's too bad this is not a video recording, because then they would actually know.
Well, then everyone would know that that's not the case.
That's not the case. I know.
All right. So the Challenger Sale, it captures a huge amount of research over the course of several years that in many ways started on the sales side with sales professionals. And in a nutshell, Jill, what we found, as you know, is in studying sales professionals, we found two things we weren't actually looking for originally, but we found that virtually every sales professional falls into one of five distinct profiles. Mm-hmm. There's a hard worker, a challenger, a relationship builder, a lone wolf, or as we like to say in the Midwest, you and me, a lone wolf, right? and a problem solver. And there's all sorts of caveats. They're not mutually exclusive. There's some overlap. But nonetheless, just the fact that there's these five profiles is very interesting. But it's when we compared them to performance and found that these challenger reps, ones that are out challenging customers' thinking, teaching those customers something new, were so much more likely to be star performers, that's when the story got really interesting. And even deeper, when we found that the relationship builder, those sales reps focused on building personal and professional relationships, being generous with their time, essentially their posture being, whatever you need, I'm here for you, those sales reps were least likely to be star performers. So the research, the book is a journey into that story, trying to understand what is it that challengers are doing. And the end point is really is an interesting one, which is it's not so much just the sales rep and a story of individual skill, but the story of sales and marketing and new product development and every other part of the commercial organization. And Challenger for us over the last 5 years has become much more a story of commercial strategy than it has of methodology or of individual skill. But just a really interesting set of findings there.
You know, and I have to tell you, when I first read the Challenger Sale, to me, the implications were so broad that it, like, just like you say, it's not just about who the salesperson is and how they behave. I mean, yes, the salesperson has to be somebody who brings ideas, insights, information to clients on a continual basis in order to be part of the discussion and to be seen as a valuable resource, but also the fact that, you know, the whole, how much marketing actually had to be involved in terms of setting up and bringing the sales reps what they need to be effective in their jobs. And it changes how you manage people as well. I mean, to me, it was a whole shift that was required.
No, I'm right there with you. In fact, a lot of our work now is on the marketing side is around what we've come to call challenger marketing. And essentially, because marketers come at Challenger largely as a sales support tool because they're getting pull from their sales department saying, hey, we found out about this challenger thing. They want help. So how can we help our sales colleagues do this? And what we're telling marketers today is that it's actually vital for sales support, but it's actually vital for everything else you're doing in marketing as well. So all the other aspects of marketing, it's a commercial strategy more than a sales strategy. So that's where a lot of our focus is right now.
It's good because it is, again, it's changing the whole game, not just the sales game. And it's saying the world has changed and what we have to do as an organization has to fundamentally change as well.
So, totally. I'm right there with you. Totally agree.
Okay. So what I want to talk about is some of the things that you and I have talked about in the interim in terms of, first of all, the length of the decision process and when people are contacting sales organizations today. And one of the things that your research is showing and a number of other companies as well is showing that customers are not contacting a sales organization till like 57% or even up to 75% of the way through their decision process. And oftentimes, if a salesperson receives a call from somebody who is in the buying mode, that person comes in with preconceived notions of what specifically they need and maybe just shopping for price at that point to try to evaluate, okay, we've got these three vendors. I've been online. I've checked them all out. I know what's out there. You and I were talking about what the role of the salesperson has to be in that situation. What are you guys recommending?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this is actually research that we conducted since the publication of the book. And so it'll be captured, in fact, it's captured in a lot of different places since we put out the book. But it's a fascinating story of when you go out and, as I often tell people, you know, the primary story of selling and marketing today is not a story of how we're selling or marketing differently. It's a story of how our customers are buying differently. Right. And the reason why that story arguably matters more than anything that we're doing in sales and marketing is because that's the story that gives everything else its urgency. It's what we call at CB the why now, right? So because when you look at Challenger and you look at all these big implications, I just got done saying it's commercial strategy and go-to-market strategy. It's big, it's complex. You can make quick wins and there's easier ways to start. But over time, it's going to be a pretty big shift. And so I think it's completely fair that someone might ask, is it even worth it? I mean, seriously, that's a lot of time, a lot of trouble, a lot of effort. And we would argue not only is it worth it, but you may in fact not have any choice because of the way the world is changing so dramatically. And primarily you see that in the very statistic that you're talking about, Jill. So when we go out and we study customers, individual stakeholders involved in a B2B purchase, and we ask them, you know, there's all sorts of things we've been asking. We've been running hundreds, if not many surveys across thousands and thousands of people in our research arm over the last several years. And as part of this work, one of the very simple questions we ask these individuals is, if you think about a typical purchase process that occurs from sort of due diligence beginning all the way to closure and a purchase decision or lack of one, I suppose, at the end, we simply ask all these individuals, at what point during that purchase process do you typically pick up the phone, fire up the email, and reach out to a supplier for their input on whatever it is you're doing? And as you noted, that answer came back at 57%. So customers are 57% of the way through a purchase before proactively at least engaging sales in the buying process. A couple things about the data. You know me, Jill, I'll go on forever, so stop me in a second. But the one thing about that data that's really interesting is it wasn't a wide distribution. It's a very narrow distribution, around 57%. In other words, it didn't run from 27 to 87%, but it ran from about 45 to 65 with an average rate of about 57. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's interesting about the data is the more complex the deal, the later your customers call you.
Now, that's pretty scary. I mean, from a sales perspective. Scary. I mean, and you know, first of all, it tells me as a salesperson that I have to get involved earlier and I have to insert myself in the decision process. I have to perhaps create the decision process because I'm not going to make my living waiting for people who are coming to me with preconceived notions.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the other thing is it's kind of a mind-bending moment from my perspective. I think for all of us, really, because you stop and think about what this 57% number means. First of all, it means that essentially customers are out there on their own doing all the things we're hoping to do with them together, right? Yeah. So identifying a need, prioritizing a need, figuring out the capabilities to meet that need, the suppliers that can deliver that capability. So by the time they approach us, there's very little left, to your point, to discuss but price. The other thing that's interesting, I mean, take a moment to think. I often ask heads of sales and marketing the following question. I'll show this. We usually show this as a big blue arrow moving across the continuum and landing at 57%. We'll ask them, think about your top two competitors. And where would you place your top two competitors on that diagram? Or even better, if I were to go out and ask your two top competitors where they place themselves on that diagram.
What's on that diagram?
It's a very simple one. This is a big blue arrow that ends at 57%. So think about the purchase continuum. And think about the point on the continuum where customers are most likely to contact you being the tip of that arrow, that 57% point. And you ask yourself, where across that continuum, if I were to ask your top two competitors where they would place themselves on that continuum relative to their customers, what would they say? And the answer is really interesting. The answer is probably at the exact same 57% point. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's not that customers empowered with information are shutting out your sales reps. Empowered with sales with information are shutting out all sales
reps.
That's
right. And rightfully so, because most salespeople, when they insert themselves into the sales process and try to reach out to customers, they don't do what the customers need them to do. I mean, they still are, in many cases, blathering brochures who really have failed to understand how, like you say, how much the customer's changed what the expectations are and how different they are. So I shut salespeople out myself. I'm a salesperson, but I keep them at bay because I know too many of them just blah, blah, blah. You know, you can't shut them up.
It's ironic, isn't it, that even salespeople don't want to talk to salespeople.
Exactly. That's pretty scary, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's a statement about our profession. Mm-hmm.
But notice where this gets us, though, because this is where it gets really interesting, right? Because, you know, if I were to ask any head of sales, any head of marketing, sort of who's your top competitor? Think to your mind the top two or three competitors you have, and we'd all list one or two companies we compete against. But in this world of the 57%, here's the mind-bending moment. In many ways, to the degree that your customers are not just shutting out your reps, but all reps, your number one competitor today isn't so much the competition and their ability to sell, Your number one competitor today is your own customer and their ability to learn on their own.
Yeah.
So we've just spent the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years building the quote-unquote customer-centric organization where the customer is at the center of everything we do and the customer is always right and the customer comes first. But in this world of 57%, if the customer is always right, we're in big trouble. And so it lands this really interesting world where it's like, what does it even mean to compete against your own customer's learning ability? But that's what it is. That's why we spend so much time talking about insight and what we call commercial insight right now at CB is all part of this challenger story is because that's the coin of the realm, the thing that allows you to compete against your competition's ability to sell and your customer's ability to learn on their own simultaneously is in fact information, and but not just information, but insight. And that's why we spend so much time talking about it.
And when you're defining what that is, what is it, for people who are listening, what does it look like, this commercial insight? How would I know it when I saw it if I was a customer?
It's a great question. We spend a lot of time talking about this right now, particularly with marketers, because we find, out, especially on the marketing side and all the big movement towards content marketing, which is a good thing to do, we get a lot of false positives. Like we'll get, oh, Brent, I totally hear you on that content thing. We're all over it. In fact, we're working very hard to become a thought leader in our industry. And so we spend a lot of time trying very hard to differentiate between between thought leadership and what we've come to call insight. So thought leadership is all the content and the data and the white papers and the information, the research, all that stuff that we all publish to essentially build our brand and to demonstrate to the world that we're experts and that we're smart, to build trust and to so that the customers see us as a place to come for information. And largely all of that work is designed to get our customers to think differently about us, that we're smarter, we're better, we're more trustworthy. Insight, on the other hand, is actually designed, it isn't really designed about getting our customers to think differently about us, but getting customers to think differently about themselves, to somehow demonstrate to them that on that journey, that independent journey towards the 57% as they've been out learning on their own, that somewhere along that pathway they've missed something materially important to their business. Some they're exposed to more risk or more cost than they realize, and as a result, they need to change what they're doing. So for us, insight is less about, well, it's not about one thing, it's about two things. It's not just about what you could be doing, but it's about what you are currently doing. And demonstrating to your customers that their current behavior is significantly opening them to cost or risk in ways they haven't fully realized. Because what you're ultimately trying to do is get your customer to change your behavior, to buy more from you, to buy at a higher margin from you, to do something different than they're doing now. But unless they see a reason to change, as good as the solution may be, if what they're doing now is good enough, that's where they're going to stay. And so, okay. So insight's all about breaking down that current behavior before building up the alternate behavior.
So let me just ask another marketing question. Could not this insight be included in the thought leadership content? Or
in fact,
do you see it being delivered other ways too?
So the way that we think about insight versus thought leadership is that in many ways, insight is a specific form of thought leadership. So the two are not diametrically opposed. In fact, the way that we draw this graphically is a Venn diagram where it's a series of nested circles where insight is nested inside of thought leadership. So kind of put it one way, all insight is probably kind of thought leadership, but not all thought leadership is insight. In other words, if you take what you do in the name of thought leadership and tweak it in certain very specific ways, we argue would become insight because it's about not just what you could be doing, but you're currently doing. And then inside that, just to kind of put a period on the end of the sentence, is ultimately what we nested inside of insight is something we call commercial insight, which is the insight that you share with your customers that changes the way they think about their business that naturally leads back to something you can help them with better than anyone else, thus allowing you to actually, because people ask us all the time, what happens if I go out and teach my customer something new, they take that great idea, put it out to bid, and my competitor wins the business. We call that free consulting, and that's just a bad place to be. So we want to make sure that the insight that we deliver to our customers leads back to something we specifically can do better than anyone else. So that's commercial insight.
Okay. That's cool. Now, we're going to get back to that question that I asked you a few minutes ago. Here you are as a salesperson, a customer who's been doing their research on the phone.
Yeah.
Oh, not on the phone. Customer's been doing their research online and has stumbled across your website, read some stuff on your website, read some stuff about you perhaps and how you are, even perhaps evaluated some evaluations on forums, etc.
Yeah.
They reach out and they contact you and they say, you know, hey, Brent, this is Jill. And, you know, I've been doing some research on, you know, sales training and we'd like to talk with you about doing objection handling training for our reps.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just an example, but it could be anything. We'd like to talk with you about this and what is your price point? How much do you charge on that? Can you tell us about your program?
Yeah.
So how should people go about handling that? We have an educated customer who's done their homework.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's a great question. So I think the knee-jerk reaction would be, first of all, you start celebrating, like, woohoo!
Yes. Oh, I'm so excited I got a hot one here.
G-Coon, here I come. I'm going to be at the President's Club this year, right? I think the first thing that any good sales rep should do, and probably actually any good sales rep probably already does, is ask some questions. So as opposed to saying, well, I'm glad you asked. Let me tell you a little bit more about our objection handling training. I think the natural reaction of the best sales reps would be to simply ask, oh, it's interesting that you guys are interested in objection handling training. I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about it. But maybe you could give me a sense for what is it about objection handling training that you're looking to accomplish? What's the bigger goal you're trying to achieve? And the reason why the very best challenger reps are asking that question is not just to build rapport or to share information, but they're essentially looking for a point of disagreement. They come to these conversations with a pretty contrarian mindset, and they're looking for what is it, where's that opportunity for me to teach that customer something they haven't fully realized. So as the customer says, well, we're interested in objection handling because we're facing these two objections. We're facing these two obstacles or these two problems or these two challenges. I think that the best sales reps say, well, it's interesting you're facing these two challenges. Have you considered this as a potential root cause? They'll go through that process of root causing that problem with their customer and trying to figure out, is in fact objection handling even the right thing to be talking about in the first place? And trying to help find an opportunity to tell that customer, to show that customer, you know, there might be a different way to think about this altogether. Now, if it just so happens that rep is only selling objection handling training and nothing else, you may or may not want to get them off at that point. That might be exactly where you want them. So, you want to broaden it from a. But even so, you'd want to make sure that your objection handling training, I would hope, has some specific aspects to it that allows you to demand a premium price for it relative to the three other shops that maybe handle objection handling training. So, I'd want to steer that customer into a point of which part of objection handling is the most important part that allows me to guide them towards essentially realizing my unique objection handling training is worth a premium price.
Mm-hmm. But you also said to look for root cause, because a lot of times when people come to the table and they say we want to do this, they're basing their decision on research that they're conducting now. They may not have done a lot of work in this area before, so they're kind of skimming the surface of the information. Even though they're doing some deep dives in certain areas, they don't have necessarily enough experience to know if they have come to the right conclusion.
That's right. In fact, we hear this all the time from heads of sales. It's so infuriating, or at least frustrating, right? It's deeply frustrating, is that customers are out there learning on their own. They get to the 57%. They package it all up in an RFP. They call up the sales organization, lay it all out, and say, here's what we want. And the sales team will look at it and say, that's not what you should want. That's actually going to hurt your business. But it's question number one is, are your customers learning on their own? Question number two is, are they getting it right? And those two are not the same thing at all, we find.
Right. They're not necessarily getting it right, because in many cases, they don't buy these products or services very often. And so, or maybe the company does buy it often, but there's so much transition within an organization that the person who is responsible or the people who are responsible maybe weren't involved the last time. And so their depth of knowledge is only skin deep sometimes, even though it appears based on the research that they've done.
That's, you know, it's not only that, you can see this, Jill, it's really interesting. You see this in the data, because when you look at core performing versus star performing sales professionals and how they're trying to engage customers, one of the things we found actually quite clearly in some research we did about 2 years ago with several thousand sales professionals is if you look at core performing sales reps and their sort of key engagement strategy, what they're trying to accomplish from a customer as part of that conversation, it's things like, I'm trying to figure out the customer's purchase process. So I'm trying to get them to teach me how this purchase is going to be made. I'm trying to figure out how different people relate to one another. So I'm trying to get them to essentially teach me their org chart. I'm trying to get them to sort of help me understand what they're doing in their business and why they need this in the first place. So it's essentially the core reps are all asking the customer to coach them through the sale. And you said what's interesting about that list is that's kind of what we've all been training on for years. It sounds like sales 101, and to see that associated with core performance, not star performance, is a weird thing. But then when we looked at the other side of the coin and looked at what star performers were doing, it actually was 180-degree difference. So what they were saying is, I'm trying to teach the customer things about the purchase process that they themselves might not have fully realized. I'm trying to help them understand that there's probably questions on the table that they haven't considered but should. I'm trying to show them the different people that they need to bring into this purchase decision that they might not fully have appreciated. And so what we're finding is star performers, no one ever told them to do this. They just kind of figured this out on their own. Rather than asking the customer to coach them through the sale, they're proactively coaching the customer through the purchase. The idea being exactly what you just said, that, you know, as while customers may be buying the solution for the first time, that supplier's been out selling it every single day, and they often will understand better how to buy the thing than the customer will themselves. And so there's this really interesting opportunity that most reps don't actually take advantage of coaching the customer through the purchase process, proactively telling them who should be involved and what they should consider and the questions they need to answer. It's a really different posture.
You know, one of my recent clients just showed me the outline they did where they really seriously went in depth in terms of how their customers make the buying process. And they used some of my stuff from Snap Selling to do this. Uh-huh. And what they ended up doing is outlining the stages on here's a map of the decision process. And now they have taken this map that they created of the decision process, who needs to be involved, when, and what's got to go on at each stage. And when they're contacted by customers, they're literally leveraging this checklist that they have to the customer and saying, look, you don't make these decisions very often. We work with customers who are doing it all the time. Here's the process that we found really makes a difference, and we'll walk you through it step by step so you know what to do and who to involve at each of the stages. And what they've found is by simply doing that, they have significantly shortened their sales cycle time.
That's fantastic. No, I'm right there with you. In fact, our research, we are totally aligned on this. We call this approach commercial coaching. It's coaching your customer with a commercial endpoint in mind. But not only is it right answer, you see it. It's a perfect example. I've got another similar story as a head of sales I know at a company we all know. He went on a ride-along recently with one of his star performers, and he told me the story. He said, Brent, it was really weird because I did this ride-along with one of my best reps to a customer who's relatively early in the purchase process, and we walk in to do have a conversation with the senior decision-makers, and the procurement officer was there, and it was really awkward. We had the conversation, the procurement person got on with it. He said, well, we were in the car on the way back to the airport, and then I looked at my sales rep and said, how in the world did procurement get invited to the meeting? And the sales rep said, well, I invited him. And the head of sales said, why in the world did you invite procurement to the meeting when it's so early? Yeah. He said, because I've learned 10 times out of 10, if you don't get him involved early, you're going to tank late, right? So he said, I encourage my customer now to get procurement involved early rather than try to do an end around. It's the same idea. It's really powerful.
Yeah, that's very cool. Now that leads me to the next topic, by the way.
Okay.
Because one of the things that I know is that you've been doing some significant research around collaboration and getting buy-in earlier in the sales process rather than waiting until a customer is late in the sales process to get everybody in the group together. You're actually talking about what salespeople now, you've done some research about what salespeople can do to get buy-in. And I think it's a pretty important topic because the number of decision makers has expanded significantly in the last few years, and the length of the decision cycle has expanded at the same time. So what have you uncovered recently?
Well, so I mentioned that the biggest story in selling today is not how we're selling differently, but how customers are buying differently. Right. And so up until now, much of our work in that story, the customer buying process, has been the thing we've already talked about, is informed customers being able to delay the interaction with sales more than ever before. But there's a whole other parallel track to that customer buying story, which is to your point, is the consensus story. The fact that there's more people and more customer stakeholders involved in a purchase, arguably, than ever before. And the thing we're particularly... Now, the consensus first showed up on our radar screen as early as 2006. So that in itself is not necessarily a new story. It's been around for a while. But the thing that fascinates us is in the last 2 or 3 years, it's morphed pretty significantly to be less a story about number and more a story about diversity. So it's not just that there's more people involved in a purchase than ever before, but there's more different people. So we all have that story. You know, it's funny, you talk to any company, any B2B company in the world, and they all have the story of we used to sell to X, and now we sell to X, Y, Z, A, B, and C, right? We used to sell to head of marketing. Now we've got an IT component, so we've got to sell to the CIO in addition. And then the C-suite's now involved, and now the head of Germany is involved, or whatever. And so there's all. So it's as we and when we don't, we actually again study. There's a lot of data, and we've done a lot of customer surveys. We've actually nailed down the number. On average, we found that on average, customers involve 5.4 different people in a typical purchase decision. So we often talk about now the 5.4. And it's not just 5.4 people that are involved, but 5.4 perspectives that are involved. And so much of our work now is essentially, it's like herding cats, to your point about longer cycle times. And it's not just longer cycle times. What we're finding is that this has massive implications on deal quality, on margins, things like that. Because if these 5.4 people can't agree, then they ultimately just settle for what we've come to call the lowest common denominator. What's the one thing we can all agree on? Well, let's try to save their company a buck, right?
Yep, so
we wind up with a low margin, small deal, or good enough for status quo because the 5.4 couldn't agree. And so that's where a lot of our work is right now.
So you've got 5.4 people involved, and they are all sitting at the table. Maybe they're not sitting at the table because they're spread out globally, or certainly in multiple offices. and they have to come together to figure out if changing their current way of doing things is worth investing in.
Yeah.
And then with whom?
Right.
So,
go ahead.
So that's a bit of a challenge, especially if you get some people involved in the decision who will be hurt possibly by the decision. It's going
right.
to put pressure on their organization. They may have to go backwards. They may not realize any benefit from it at all.
Yeah.
And you've got others who can't wait to get going, and you got to hold them back because they're terrifying everybody as they're trying to ram something through the organization.
That's right.
Okay, so you've got this diversity, and then you got the financial guy who all he cares about is the numbers, and the
HR
people that's going, well, that, you know, how are people going to feel about this, and how will it impact? Okay, so we've got all these people. What is working to bring them together and create consensus earlier on?
Yeah. Well, so to get to what's working, let me first tell you what's not working. And this is because it's kind of how we roll, but it's also really interesting, right?
Yeah,
So the traditional approach that I think most of us would adopt in a world of the 5.4, and to your point, they are sometimes literally together, sometimes they're only figuratively together around a table, right? So they could be spread out. But generally speaking, the strategy that most of us adopt is what I call a track them down and win them over strategy, right? So I find my first thing I got to do is figure out who the 5.4 are in the first place.
Right.
And sometimes it's not clear. Sometimes your customers don't even know. But let's assume for a second I can figure that out, who's involved in the purchase decision. The idea is approach them one by one and make a pitch to them as compellingly as I possibly can to paint a picture of my offering that speaks to their unique needs and to their unique priorities so that I win them over. And once I win over number one, then I move on to number two. And I do the same thing and I tailor my offering to make sure that they're on board and I win them over and move on to number three. And so we collect a series of yeses. And we think that if I can connect each one of those individuals more closely to my offering to me, that the one plus one plus one and so on will equal agreement. And as one of our members at CB in sales marketing told us, he said, the problem, the world I live in is I've got this problem of 1 + 1 + 1 = 0. In other words, I go and win over each of the individuals, and then I think I've got the deal in the bag because each one of them has looked at me and said yes, and yet when they all get together around a table or figuratively or literally and have a discussion, the deal falls apart anyway, right? And so what we found is, you know, by far, it's kind of the bumper sticker sort of conclusion of all this is, in many ways, this problem of consensus and diversity in 5.4 is less of a selling problem. It is absolutely that, and we have to figure that out. But it's just as much a buying problem, because the problem here isn't so much that those individuals don't appreciate our offering, it's that they can't agree with each other. And so the bumper sticker phrase we often use for this work right now is that, you know, is it the problem with overcoming, the challenge of overcoming consensus today is not so much doing a better job of connecting individual stakeholders to us, is doing a better job of connecting those individual stakeholders to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes really interesting because that's actually a very different sort of dynamic. Because if you think about what those individual stakeholders are disagreeing about or where they're failing to reach consensus, what they're struggling to agree on, we actually know this from data too. It turns out the thing they're struggling to agree on is not whether or not you're a great supplier, but whether or not a problem is even worth solving in the first place and what the right solution to that problem is, irrespective of supplier.
Right.
And so it's to your point about earlier conversation, that's where we need to plug in to help the 5.4 is not what to decide whether or not we're the best answer, but rather not whether that solution is even worth pursuing irrespective of our answer. It's a very different dynamic.
It's a hugely different dynamic.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what you have, I see this happen in my world all the time too. You know, like, what do you do when they don't all come to the table thinking that it's going to change? What have you found that's working and helping to get this consensus that the problem is worth doing something about at an earlier stage?
Well, a couple of things we found. So one of the things we found last year in our marketing work that's really interesting to us is, first of all, when you look at this biggest, the most likely point of disagreement across the 5.4, again, it's not the supplier, but it's the problem identification and the solution selection, irrespective of supplier. And it peaks at solution selection, just getting agreement on what we should even do in the first place. And when we asked customers at what point in the purchase process do you typically reach that disagreement point, that sort of node where consensus is likely to either form or fall apart around the solution, that point turns out to be 37% of the way through the purchase process. So now take these two numbers I put out here so far and put them together. It's really interesting. So
there's a huge drop-off point. I mean, there's a huge drop-off point.
That's exactly right. So think about what this means. It's really interesting. Now, if customers left to their own devices are unlikely to contact a supplier until 57% of the way through the purchase, but consensus is most likely to fail at 37% of the way through the purchase. I often ask marketers, how many deals have we lost over the years that we never even knew were on the table to begin with because customers never could reach consensus around moving forward? And the answer is, who knows? It's an unknowable thing. But as a result of all that, what we're finding is a reactive strategy for consensus is not going to work, right? So we have to essentially go out and build consensus as opposed to just wait for consensus to fall apart and then try to stitch it back together. That also means there's a huge role for marketing to play around the consensus issue here too. So if sales is only called in later and has to sort of reactively stitch together consensus, then marketing's going to have to play a bigger role. And so we've come at this from a marketing angle and a sales angle. And one on the marketing side is it's a lot about the language and the collateral and the messages and the content that we create needs to be constructed in a way where multiple stakeholders can see themselves in it in a way where they see agreement as opposed to divergence. So a lot of the work in marketing around personas and personalization and tailoring of content, while important, if done too far or done in the wrong way, could actually create more distance across stakeholders as opposed to greater connections across stakeholders. And so all of our answers, whether they're sales or marketing right now, are really focused on how do we do a better job of making an individual, personal, tailored connection that also sets someone up simultaneously for connecting with others at the same time? So some of that is through different designs of messaging and collateral. Some of that's just designed in ways of creating collective learning across a customer group, for example, and some really interesting things that we're just looking at, just learning to understand right now.
So I'm going to ask you you've talked about marketing. I'm going to ask you, how would you say to salespeople who've, they've initiated a conversation with...
Yeah.
With Eric, they've got a call with Eric, and they've met with Eric, and Eric is interested, or has expressed interest, and he said, we're kind of thinking about, if we should change or not.
Yeah.
What should a salesperson be doing if Eric is sort of interested and thinks that it's going to be hard to reach his goals unless they do something different?
Okay, got it. So I'm selling to Eric. Now, that traditionally... If I'm a good sales professional, I'm prepping well, I'm doing my research, and what I'm trying to do is understand Eric as deeply as I can, right? So what is Eric's role in the organization? What is Eric's function? What traditionally do people in Eric's function look for? What are his needs? And I'll do some of that on my own pre-discovery. Some I'll do it in the interaction, trying to figure that out in the moment. That's all still really important. None of that goes away. But traditionally, what we do is we'd figure that out and then tailor our offering as closely as we can to whatever we find out, right?
Right.
But the other thing that we find, again, the best reps are doing is asking a different set of questions altogether. So other than or beyond Eric, who else is involved in this purchase decision? Is it Janet or is it Susan or is it, or think of roles, is it the CFO or the procurement officer? And by the way, if Eric doesn't know that, to what degree do I need to show Eric or teach Eric who else is going to your point earlier about coaching the customer, right? So who else should be involved? Same idea is like, is there some ways I could help Eric? First of all, can I help Eric understand who else is going to have to be involved in this purchase? Second of all, are there ways that I can help Eric understand what those people care about around my solution or around the solution, around the area that my solution speaks to? And three, can I equip Eric to better speak to them in terms that they care about, so that when Eric goes to make a business case or just a case for my solution or a course of action that my solution speaks to, is Eric better equipped to have that conversation with 4.4 other people who act very differently, talk very differently, care about very different things? Am I essentially equipping Eric to be a good advocate for that course of action? Because we'll find, and we actually profile a case from Marketo right now, and it's a really neat best practice from Marketo. So Marketo is selling marketing automation to heads of marketing, but the problem is, if the head of marketing says, I want marketing automation, it's a great tool, and then the head of marketing has to go to the CIO to get sign-off because it's an IT tool. But the trouble is, the IT person will say, we already have a CRM system. It's like, no, it's not a CRM system. It's totally different, right? So they don't understand. So does that CMO, is that CMO equipped to understand what CIOs care about, what language they use, what are the objections, all the things that we prepare our sales reps to do, objection handling, better talking points, better use of language, better stories. Can we equip our mobilizers, the Erics of the world, to be better equipped to have those conversations on our behalf as well?
That's cool. Now, do you suggest too? Because this is where I've seen a lot of star performers do this too. They're kind of calling the quorum. They're saying, Eric, we got to get these people in a room soon, because the longer we wait to get the people in the room, the more problems you're going to have if this is something that you really want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. The trick is, though, is not to get them in a room, but what you do with them once you get them in the room.
Yeah, I suppose. So,
right. So because if you get them in a room and do a product demo, we found in our data actually is pretty clear on that. That's that, again, it's not going to help you very much because if you get them in a room, which is great, but then do a product demo, then you're solving for the wrong problem. Because again, because what you're doing in the product demo is trying to win them over for you as the supplier as opposed to someone else. But again, that's not the point of disagreement, is not who's the right supplier.
Right.
But rather, get them in a room and have a conversation about what they're trying to accomplish.
Right.
Irrespective of supplier.
Okay, cool. Well, listen, our time is up and I truly appreciate it. Now, for anybody who's listening, I do want to recommend getting the Challenger Sale because it's absolutely a mind-changing book and it'll open up a lot of thinking for you. But
I
can't wait till your next one comes out too. So thanks so much for everything today, Brett.
You are welcome, Jill. And congratulations on the new book. We're super excited for you. It's great
stuff.
You.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon. Yeah, thanks.
All right, bye-bye. Bye-bye.